With that wonderful introduction that I got from Anthony, I'm really happy to be here and share with you my book. So my book is one that's really very interesting. Anthony gave you the title of the school that I actually founded in 2007, the Khalil Gibran International Academy, which is the first dual language public school in the United States. Founding that school actually inspired me to do the research. I don't know how many people know my story. Okay. One person knows my story, which is great. When I founded the school and it became public, there was a great deal of hoopla about the school. People were afraid of the school, that it was actually going to be indoctrinating children to become homegrown terrorists, that the school was actually a madrasa. And so the pressures kept mounting and mounting by the negative publicity that was actually being put out there. The mayor of the city of New York at that time, Bloomberg, actually pressured me to leave my position. So I was forced by him and the chancellor then, based on a New York Post article where they actually distorted my words and took them out of context. So when all of that happened, and I was actually involved in litigation against the Department of Education and the city for being removed forcibly and what have you, I decided to look and see if there were other American Muslim principals in public education who were experiencing any adversity. And so in my doctoral program at Fordham University, I took that up as the study that I wanted to do for my dissertation. So so what I decided to do was actually see who's out there and what experiences they had. And the most important thing that I wanted to know was about their lived experiences, whether or not the political discourse, which we always hear in the media, the global events, that there's always something happening somewhere in the world, and then the media coverage of Islam and Muslims. I wanted to see if these three things affected their leadership and their spirituality. So in regards to leadership, it takes a lot to be a school leader, right? A big responsibility for a school leader to take on. It's a 24-hour job. They're held to a standard that no other profession holds individuals, and wanted to see what it's like for them as Muslims. Second, their leadership. As we all know, you know, various communities have various ways of observing. And so, for example, for me as a woman, I wear headscarf. And I wanted to see if other women who wore headscarf were experiencing anything. Or other Muslim leaders who had, you know, Muslim-sounding names were experiencing anything negative. And so when I first started the study, I looked here in New York City to see if I could find people to be a part of it. Sadly, I was not able to find people who would be interested in actually being a part of the study. They were too afraid to be in it because of their identities being exposed and retribution by the DOE, etc. So I had to cast the net out really wide and look across the nation to see if I can get people. So in total, from New York City to across the country, I found 20 people. Of the 20 people, only 14 agreed to be a part of the study. After weeks of conversations with them of how I promised that I will make sure to protect their identities and make sure that they're safe. And so the research took place during the fall of 2015 and then in the spring of 2016, which I did my follow-up interviews. And those were really very fascinating. Because at that time, we were at the peak of the presidential race. So each and every one of these principals who I had done the follow-up interview with all talked about the Muslim ban and how terrified they were if President Trump, if Trump became the president, which now, sadly, we've seen that he's become the president. So the findings that emerged from this study are really, really fascinating. There were actually six themes that came across. And when I did the research, I looked through the political spectacle framework by Murray Edelman. I don't know if any of you here are academics and know anything about political spectacle, but it's really very fascinating because what Murray Edelman talked about was We are all characters within a scene. And the cast of characters that actually manipulate and monopolize situations to make them into political spectacle are usually elected officials, lobbying groups, interest groups, individuals who want to have a personal gain in something. And so what we saw, sadly, is that political spectacle plays out in everything, whether it's in education, whether it's in Washington, D.C., whether it's in, you know, housing, you know, poverty. We see, you know, all the time that there are different views on an issue, and there are competing views trying to get the public to actually take a position. And sadly, sometimes the people with the loudest voices end up monopolizing it and basically making people think that this is the best way to approach a situation. So that's political spectacle. So that was the lens that I looked at in terms of the study. So the emerging themes that came out were political climate. Each and every one of them felt that the political climate affected them, and I'll give you an example of what that looks like. Whenever there was anything that pertained to politics, and there was an elected official, or during the presidential race, anything that was said that was anti-Muslim, they, the following day in their buildings, heard their staff talking about it, or heard the kids and their parents talking about it, and just felt like this sense of like, oh, here we go again. And just so tired of this anti-Muslim rhetoric that when we think about it as individuals, this can, you know, actually affect your morale as an individual. So that's the political climate that they were talking about in terms of it affecting them. The next is the role of the media. The position that the media takes is one that's really fascinating. And we all know that when the media decides to cover something, they only choose to cover the things. And you know that saying, what leads is the thing that bleeds. This is what they were talking about, that all the good things that people are doing, like soup kitchens, like volunteering to clean their schoolyard, etc., none of that ever makes the news. But when there's something negative and awful that happens, that gets covered. And they felt that the media perpetuates, you know, even further anti-Muslim sentiment because they hear it all the time and see it all the time in the media. The next is inferior and foreign. Sadly, majority of them at times were made to feel that by their colleagues, by parents, and by district level personnel who always treated them differently from other people who worked in the district because of the fact that they were Muslim. And so, you know, an example of that is not including them in a lot of social activities like they would, you know, other colleagues. And so they always felt that that was something that made them feel inferior in terms of being invited and to be a part of things. And also what was interesting is one of the people within the book, specifically, his name is Aziz. And Aziz basically talks about walking into a school setting or a district setting or a professional development session where nobody really knows him. And he's this really very handsome, well-built, muscular gentleman who walks into the room, commands authority. But as soon as he utters his name, Aziz Mahmoud, he can see the reaction on people's faces because he's African-American, but then with this Muslim name. And he senses like it just overshadows, you know, this authoritative figure that he is perceived to be from his looks. But then his name says something else. And that's a point that he talked about, that he felt inferior and foreign. Another story is actually a principal who actually went with her husband and a friend of hers. All three of them are Muslim. They went to Florida. And they went to see this special property that they were giving, you know, tours to. And so her husband and her friend, who didn't wear hijab, actually were the ones that the gentleman kept talking to and making eye contact. And she was just observing them. And then finally, she interjected into the conversation, and he had this surprised look on his face, like, oh, she can talk. She knows how to talk English. And so she was very taken aback by that. And as he started to tell them about the numbers of what this property would cost, and she's just standing there, and she's looking at him and looking at her husband and her friend, who she said, you know, my husband and my friend, the two of them combined don't make the amount of money that I make as a principal. But yet this gentleman was engaging them as if though they were better than me, and that they had, because they looked, you know, modern and they fit in, and all those things. So these are also ways that some of them felt inferior and foreign, as an example for you. The next theme is actually unconscious fear. This one was really, really fascinating because it played out with all of them, always, always making sure that they thought twice about everything that they said, the way that they said it, making sure that they don't say anything that will in any shape, way, or form make them seem like they're extremist or that they're sympathizers, you know, with anything that's happening in the world, or that they, you know, have an agenda. And what's sad is that each and every one of them felt this. And so examples of this is one principal whose students, a high school, whose students actually came to him asking to go to the mosque on Friday afternoon for prayer. He basically said to them and the families, you need to bring me permission slips and you are welcome to go. They brought in the permission slips. They were able to go. The imam also gave them a letter, you know, for them to be able to. And the imam and the principal himself was also going to Friday prayer. So someone reported him taking the kids to the mosque as if though he's promoting Islam. And sadly, he underwent a thorough investigation accusing him of promoting Islam. And from that experience and another experience the same year of a couple of teachers saying, I'd like to go to pray, can I have it? And he created flexible scheduling for them to be able to leave. What underwent this investigation by the district because he allowed this to happen. Sadly, it took over a year for this investigation to finalize. They didn't find anything, you know, but it left a very large scar on this man because he spent the whole entire year worrying about whether he's going to have a job or not. And from that experience, what ended up happening with Aziz is that he no longer wants to engage the kids in any conversation about Islam. He doesn't want to engage about them going to the mosque. He allows one of his assistant principals to handle that whole situation. And when I asked him why, he's like, after what happened to me, I don't want to get another slap in the hand such as this. So this is what I'm talking about in terms of the unconscious fear that they're constantly fearing over and over in everything and in anything that they're doing as school principals. The next one is spirituality. I really wanted to see, like, you know, what it was like for them spiritually. Now, I don't know how many of you know in terms of the Islamic practice. Muslims pray 5 times a day. They also fast the month of Ramadan. And so these are questions that I asked them. And there are a number of them that actually don't even tell their families or their school community that they're Muslim. They don't fast Ramadan. They don't go to make the Friday prayer. And if it comes up in a question what their religion is, they will simply answer in saying that they're culturally Muslim, that they're not practicing. And each and every one of them, in some shape, way, or form, has this lingering guilt because they're not able to actually be true to their faith and uphold this position. And so this was actually something that many of them actually struggled with in terms of being true to their faith and true to their leadership. One particular gentleman who is in the study actually, he felt so guilty that he tried to figure out a way to still be able to make that Friday prayer. And he found in his community a mosque that actually live streams the Friday prayers. And so what he did on Friday was tell his secretary, I'm going to go in my office for 30 minutes. what I would like for you to do is do not call me or knock on the door unless it's an emergency. And he actually closed the door in his office, watch the live stream, take out his prayer rug, pray, and then resume his business as a school principal. This was his way of being able to stay connected to his faith. And when he shared that with me, I had gotten goosebumps because I've never heard anybody go through such lengths to try to stay connected to their faith. And when I asked him, why don't you just tell your superintendent to let you go? He's like, I'm too afraid to ask for something like that. I don't know what they will perceive me. I don't know what they'll think of me. And I don't even want to go down that path. Another principal who I asked the same question, he said to me, I made my peace with being actually observant Muslim. And I said, well, can you tell me more? And he said to me, he said, you know, the thing that I fear the most, because his school is actually in a very dangerous area, is if one of my children gets shot through a window and I'm not in the building, I'm actually at the mosque, the thing that's going to make the news is not the young boy or girl that was shot in my school. It's the principal that was at the mosque that will make the headlines. And that's what frightens him about even asking or leaving his building. So this is the struggle that many of them, in terms of spirituality, are facing and enduring. The next one is education and communication. The last two is really very fascinating because what I found in this, it's an additional finding. Many of them talked about opportunities where something happened serendipitously in a positive way that actually gave them the opportunity to talk positively about their faith or their identities. And one example is within this study, this woman and her husband, who was wearing hijab, was wearing this beautiful, overflowing scarf. And her husband were actually on a sailboat touring somewhere, and the wind kept blowing into the scarf. And there was this woman who was just mesmerized by the wind blowing into the scarf. And she said to her, she's like, your scarf is so beautiful, and the way that it's just waving in the wind, it's so beautiful. And so she said to her, why did you decide to wear it? And so this person in the book basically said, well, it's a part of my religion. And she's like, well, what religion are you? And she told her, I'm Muslim. And she's like, oh, and do all Muslims wear, you know, a headscarf? And so there was this really beautiful conversation that this woman learned something about Muslim women and the wearing of the hijab. And so that experience, when she retells it in the study, was something that really made her happy because it was one time that she was engaging, you know, about her faith tradition in a positive way that didn't make her feel uncomfortable, but actually proud. And so that's what this aspect is. And there were a number of other people who talked about opportunities that presented themselves in a positive way to talk. And then a last finding, which I don't have on this slide, is actually collective guilt. Many of them felt that every time they heard something negative on in the media, that somehow people around them made them feel this sense of collective guilt, where they, in fact, didn't feel that it was fair to actually be put, on with all of this guilt of what someone in the other part of the world is doing, and that they should be responsible for it, and how heavy this was for them, and how they just wish that people would stop doing that. And so it was really, really fascinating to hear some of their stories. So the conclusions of this study is basically, as you see here, political rhetoric affects human interactions and the psyche of American Muslims in leadership positions, sadly. You know, whether it was the presidential race, which I talked about earlier, how they were all frightened by the whole Muslim ban, and just were like, what does that mean? One of them, in fact, said that if that were the case, that he would seriously think about relocating from the United States if Trump ever became president. And I have yet to connect with them to see if he actually left or not. The next one is Muslim religious identity plays a significant role in their job performance, especially for the women who are very self-identifiable as Muslim because they wear the headscarf, that they found that it really took a onus on them. And I'll give you an example in terms of what this actually means. Within the study, there were 6 African Americans. And then the other 6 were Middle Eastern, some born over state in the United States and some born outside of the United States. And one of the women who is African American and wears hijab said that she believes that she is doubly affected. And I said to her, well, what do you mean by that? She said, well, I am African American, I am a woman, and I'm a Muslim in hijab. And she felt that she was always having to prove herself 3 times more than her peers because of these multiple identities that she was actually straddling. The next one is American Muslims continuously forced to recognize the status of the other. I mentioned that earlier, that some of them always felt this sense like they're different and they were made to feel that way by their colleagues, by their superiors. They believe that political correctness is vital for their performance. I mentioned that earlier, that they were always very self-conscious and always being politically correct in whatever it is that they said. Thinking twice about what they were saying was something that was really, always prevalent on their minds. And next, American Muslim principals, especially those who are female, experience a strong sense of judgment and discrimination. And it's specifically the women that actually were in hijab. One of the women, who was in the study, in the aftermath of September 11th, she was actually wearing the headscarf and then decided to take it off. And I'm actually going to talk about some of these subjects. This one right here, Najla, was actually a teacher during the time of September 11th, a third-year teacher, elementary school, and she that day on 9/11 went to the auditorium, found her colleagues sitting there watching the TV, and she was trying to figure out what was going on, and they all looked at her and said to her, Arabs and Muslims did this to us. And they all looked at her with like this incriminating look as if though she was responsible for it. And she was so petrified and shocked by what she heard. She ran back into her room and just started crying and crawled under the desk. Her aspirations before this was actually to become a school leader. And over the course of the years after 9/11, came to the conclusion with her family that if she really wanted to be a leader, that she would have to actually take off the hijab. And someone in her district said to her, if you really want to be a school leader, then you should think about changing your wardrobe. Code language for take off your headscarf. And sadly, that's what she ended up doing. She then went through a leadership program, became an assistant principal and a principal now, and actually now is working on a district level. But this is what she endured in terms of, aspiring to a career that she wanted, but at the same time having to compromise her faith tradition. Rula is also very, very interesting. Her case was she took on a failing charter school. After 3 years, it was on the brinks of closing. After 3 years, she was actually able to get the school to get an A grade. The school board decided that they were going to hire an executive director to help her so she could just focus on instruction and just making the school much better instructionally. She was a part of the process in terms of identifying the executive director and interviewing a couple of people. The board didn't finalize who they were going to hire from the people that she was privy to. She went on summer vacation, came back, and found out they hired someone. But they didn't hire any of the people that she had sat and interviewed with them. Who they hired was actually a 9/11 family member. And in her first encounter with her, where you are just getting to know one another and having a conversation with one another, the executive director asked Rula, are you Muslim? Is your husband Muslim? Are you a practicing Muslim? Within the first 5 minutes of them getting to know one another. We all know that these are illegal questions to ask. of an employer to ask of their employees. Rula knew that these were illegal questions to ask, but didn't know what to make of it and wanted to set a good impression on this woman, and genuinely and open-heartedly answered these questions and thought that things were going to be better, that they were going to build a relationship. Sadly, Rula spent the whole entire year being harassed with microaggression after microaggression until finally, in the spring, she was under so much pressure and duress because she was always criticizing her not having enough professional development, that how does she want the school to do great if she herself is not investing in time to go and get professional development for herself. But mind you, the school for 2 years had A grades because of her efforts. But what she was doing was just chipping away at her leadership. And because she knew she was Muslim, she would do things basically to make her feel, you know, like the other. An example of that, she brought in sausages. She's Italian. Brought in sausages and started eating it with other staff. And she turns around to Rula and says, oh, that's right, you don't eat pork. You'll just never know what you're missing. So little things like this were always being said and done to Rula that she finally, in the spring, under so much duress, fainted in the school. She was taken out by EMS, taken to the hospital. The executive director didn't call to check on her. The school board didn't call. 2 weeks later, she comes back to work, tries her best to do what she can do. She wrote a 14-page letter to the school board letting them know what she had experienced through the whole school year and how she needs support in this situation. And sadly, at the end of the school year, they sent her a letter telling her they were discontinuing her contract as the principal. What's even more outrageous is that Rula, since that experience, now is on medication for life for seizures because of what she experienced. Aziz, I told you his story about the mosque and the disciplinary hearing. And then Ayman, who was really very interesting, he was the opposite from all of these people in terms of his Muslimness. When I pursued him to be in the study, he was like, I'm the wrong person for you. I don't believe in Islam. I don't want to have anything to do with Islam. I hate Muslims. I think Muslims, you know, the plight of Muslims right now is all their fault. And everything that, you know, that Fox News says is true. And I was like, oh my God, I need you in this study. So I sat there and I listened to him just epitaph after epitaph of things that he was saying. In terms of how he was feeling about his faith tradition. And in the study, when I talk about, I took a poll of, you know, 1 to 10, how did they feel about, you know, spiritually connected to Islam? And then he rates himself a 7. And I was like, okay, can you explain? So he talks about his childhood and the stepmother, his stepmother who his father had married, who was actually British and became Muslim. He reminisced on how much she loved Islam and how she actually was an observant Muslim and thought that that was so powerful and beautiful that he remembers that and finds affinity to that experience. So it was really fascinating. But from everybody, he was always very critical. And one thing that he was critical about, which we hear all the time, is that you know, how come Muslims are not condemning all the things that are happening in the world? And he's like, why aren't they speaking? Why aren't they condemning? You know, there's all of these leaders. There's all of these universities. And, of course, as a researcher, I couldn't say to him, well, you can go here and check this, or you could read it here and you can find it here. I left it alone. And after I completed the entire study, I sent him an email thanking him for participating. And I said to him, I said, you know, remember you had asked that question of why aren't leaders actually, Muslim leaders globally saying anything? You know, here are a couple of sites that you can actually, statements from, you know, right after 9/11 up until the present day, that you can see statement after statement from organizations and academics and scholars in the Muslim community, which sadly the media never cares to promote or to you know, put in the media for people to really know and understand what's going on. And so he just, you know, he emailed me back saying thank you, and that was it. I never had any contact with him. So these are the four subjects that I actually cover, tell their stories more in depth. Had I done all 14 people, my book would probably be like 800 pages. And I did not want a very long book because I really wanted to get the book in the hands of more people than that. Now, when I started doing this study, what was really fascinating was I was the first to write about this group, first about American Muslims in public education. And when I sat down with my advisor and I told him I could not find any literature, he said to me, well, then identify other communities that face adversity in the United States. So I looked at Japanese Americans, Chinese Americans, African Americans, women, I mentioned African Americans, and then I also looked at Catholics and Jews. So when he went over my 200-page literature review, he said to me, he says, Debbie, I'm going to, you know, give you some feedback, and I just want you to brace yourself because you're not going to need all this. And I said, okay, what do you mean? He says, we're going to take everything out, and the only thing you're going to leave in here is literature on Catholics and Jews and what their experience was when they first migrated to the United States. He said the most emblematic theme that keeps reoccurring for your study is actually bigotry. Muslims are facing bigotry. Catholics face bigotry when they first migrated to this country, as well as Jews when they first migrated to this country. And so I really think that that's really the most important part. So the book also contains the history of Islam and Muslims dating back to pre-Columbus. And the fact that, you know, people seem to, there's this notion that Islam is an immigrant religion, but it's not. The majority of Muslims in the United States are actually African American. And we look historically, within the slave trade, 20% of slaves that were brought to the United States were actually Muslim. And sadly, over the course of the years, they were actually forced to leave Islam by their slave masters. And so this is also chronicled in the book. So recommendations for practice, which are really, really critical, is that there needs to be more studies on American Muslim educators in public schools. I'm the first to do it on principals. There isn't really any study specifically on teachers who are Muslim to really see what their experience is. And what's interesting over the course of the years, right here in New York, where I've run into teachers who are teaching like for 15, 18, 20 years, American Muslim teachers, I'm like, why haven't you gone into school leadership? Why don't you become a assistant principal? And I can't begin to tell you how many of them said to me, after what happened to you, I don't even want to think about it. So that's really critical, that we really see what it's like for them as well. And what's interesting is also there are very little studies specifically about Catholics and Jewish teachers and principals in public education as well, because I struggle to find that from my own research. And so for anybody who's an academic and focusing on Judaism or Catholicism, it's fascinating to see that there is really a gap in literature there too. Another recommendation is that there needs to be research that provides Muslim educators with the support and encouragement. And this really specifically speaks to universities. What are universities doing to cultivate school leadership, right? And teachers, you know, diversifying the workforce. That's really critical. Workshops focused on Muslims in America to encourage dialogue among school communities. As I had mentioned, a lot of them, you know, were too afraid to talk about their own, you know, faith, their own customs and rituals. And what better than to actually have school districts that are having these kinds of trainings that they can actually learn this about their students and about their staff. Curriculum, making curriculum readily available in schools and universities, you know, as well as, you know, the K-12 school system. And this is really the way to mitigate, right, anti-Muslim rhetoric and sentiment and bullying of children, which actually a study that was done by ISPU, which is the Institute for Social and Policy Understanding, they found that 1 in 4 children are actually bullied and bullied by teachers, adults in their schools, who are Muslim children that are bullied by adults, sadly. Partnerships with organizations that conduct professional development and informational presentations, something that, you know, all schools and school communities and districts should do. National organizations of American Muslim principals. One of the questions was, if there was an association of American principals, would you be interested to participate? Out of the 14, 12 of them said yes. 2 of them were too afraid and didn't want to be associated because they didn't know if they would be in any way marginalized or targeted for being a part of an association. And lastly, policy that allows American Muslim employees to attend religious services on Friday afternoons. Something that is a no-brainer, giving them their 1 hour to be able to go freely without feeling targeted or, you know, afraid for their jobs, to be able to fulfill that. And interestingly, this is actually a mandate for men, but optional for women, and so it would be really great. And here in New York, there is actually a clause, an act actually that, you know, provides you that opportunity. As we know, the Jewish community on Fridays, they leave early for Sabbath. And so it would be no different giving them that 1 hour as a part of the law. So that is the entire presentation of the book. I am happy to take questions about the subjects, about the research, and then happy to sign books. Yes?
Do you have any recommendations in terms of curriculum? Because I know people who have been trying to work within their schools in New York City bring in kind of books and other material for K-12 elementary school. They had some trouble finding good material.
So. Yeah. So that's actually still a work in progress, where actually there are a bunch of American Muslim educators that are actually putting stuff together. So, for example, and there's been also a really good partnership with Teaching Tolerance, you know, the website, right, and then the magazines that they provide. So they've actually provided a number of materials on their website that were actually devised by educators. So you can find a great deal of information there. And then also my website, Bridging Cultures Group, which actually provides professional development training on Arabs, Muslims, and South Asians for, you know, for teachers, you know, students, you know, everyone. And so there is on the website, there is actually a list of books on Arab, Muslim, and South Asian, you know, students. It's literature, you know, for elementary, middle school, and high school. And then there is also, like, professional reading that you want to read to learn more about these communities. Yeah. Yes?
Apart from education, mm-hmm. Are there any things that you can tell us about Muslims who are active in leadership positions in the business community? Mm-hmm. In other institutional endeavors, whether it's private or whether it's public, and any studies that's been done about Muslims.
There hasn't, and that's a really excellent question that you asked. There hasn't been yet. During the time that I was doing the study, I was traveling and also going to a lot of conferences just to meet more people and try to network to get more subjects. And every time that I had mentioned what I was doing, I ran into someone who worked in corporate America, who worked in the nonprofit sector, who worked for the government, and they just started sharing with me their own personal experiences. And I was like, oh, my God, this is just awful. I mean, some of the stories, like one woman who actually worked in Wall Street, who was actually South Asian, didn't wear hijab. Her name didn't sound Muslim. And basically, she said she was in a boardroom where they were saying anti-Muslim things. And all she could do was just sit there, and she just literally sank in her chair, not knowing what to do. And she was petrified. One, she was like, if I speak up, I don't know how they're going to treat me. And just chose not to. And just pretended like it wasn't a big deal. And so when she was sharing this with me, she's like, I didn't even know what to do, and I don't even know what to do right now. I'm afraid that I'm going to lose my job if I stand up for Muslims because I'm a Muslim. And so it was really, really sad to hear that. And then, you know, someone else who actually worked for government, and he felt the same way, that he was basically looked at differently and treated differently because of his faith tradition. So it's interesting, and I hope that somebody will actually go out there and do a study. And so one of my book readings is going to actually be happening with this organization called Muslim American Professionals, which is actually an international group, a network that they actually hold these conferences. So they heard about my book launch, and they weren't able to come. But when I was talking to them about how this book transcends leadership, yes, I'm talking about school leaders. But school leaders are CEOs of organizations when we really think about it, right? They're running an organization. They're running a school. It's no different than someone running a business or a company. And so what they are experiencing, you know, in other sectors may very well be the same. So they're actually going to be putting together a panel discussion where I'm going to present the book, but also bring people from the various sectors to share about their own experiences and whether they heard anything about it, but then going even a step further of how to create actually a support group for people in like the private sector and corporate America to help them overcome some of these challenges. So thank you for that question.
I think it's really fascinating, Joanna, and I really appreciate that how important this work is. I was curious if among the people that you profiled, if you had someone who had kind of the exceptional experience of getting the right support and actually feeling like they could kind of experience their Muslim identity as integrated with their role as a principal and have that be a positive for the school as opposed to something
else. Yeah, that's a really great question. So within the study, I didn't include it in the book, but within the study, which you can actually get on ProQuest, there were three principals that actually led and heavily populated student Muslim students in the school. But their staff were not Muslim, majority white, African American, etc. But the school community was mostly Muslim. So they didn't really face anything with their parents and with their children. But when they went to district meetings or they went to conferences is when they were feeling that othering. And what's interesting, with one of them, when I had gone to the city that they actually work in, I had asked her to meet me in the next town over. And she literally said to me, I'm really sorry, but I don't leave my town. And I said to her, is there something wrong with the town next door? Because I actually am going to be staying there at the hotel. And she's like, no, I just don't want a chance, you know, experiencing any kind of incident. And so I literally had to go to their town to do the interviews in an area that they were able to arrange for me to meet individually with them. But they felt that they had it made because, you know, it's, you know, similar community. They didn't really have to experience anything with their families, with their students. And then the teachers who've been there for a very long time really understand the culture and the, you know, the religion, that they didn't have as much discriminatory, you know, understandings about the community. So that was really fascinating. Yes?
Apart from your study, I want to get back to New York City and teaching of Arabic in schools, the Khalil Gibran School. I mean, if you can give us an update on does that school still exist?
It does exist. It still does exist. So When I had opened it, it was actually a 6 to 12. Now it's only a 9 to 12th grade. It's a high school. It was originally supposed to be an Arabic dual language school, which if you know anything about languages, you need to study it 7 years, you know, minimum, to be able to be equally fluent in it. So when they shrunk it from a 6 to 12 to a 9 to 12, now it's just a second language. It's in downtown Brooklyn. The principal actually is not of Arab American background or speaks Arabic. And he is actually like the sixth principal after everything. I don't know how closely you followed my situation, but I had filed a lawsuit and I filed an Equal Employment Opportunity Commission complaint, and they actually ruled in my favor in 2010. And I had the opportunity to go back to the school, but chose not to, because already I would have been the fifth principal to go back. And then I was already in my doctoral program, and I just felt that it was much more important for me to do this work and to speak publicly on what happened to ensure that this doesn't happen to anybody, not just members of my community, but anybody.
So the students at this high school, if they want to take Arabic, mm-hmm. they can take it just as students in other schools mm-hmm. in the city where Arabic is offered. I mean, you know, I don't know how many schools offer Arabic.
A small number.
I think, right?
There's a small number. And in fact, right now, the mayor's office and the chancellor's office just released, they're developing like about 40-something the pre-K and 3-K for all. Dual language programs, and sadly, there is not one Arabic.
Really?
No.
So what?
Which was really, really surprising and disappointing, because there is a very large Arabic-speaking population, specifically in Brooklyn and in the Bronx. There's a large Yemeni American community in the Bronx that could benefit from Arabic. Yeah.
That would be the language of an immigrant family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, with the war now in Yemen and people fleeing Yemen and their families are able to petition for them to come to the United States, there are a lot of children who could benefit. Yeah. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay, great. Anyone else?
I just wonder if you've done any study discrimination, hating Muslim people among the American Americans.
Yeah, there is a lot. The book the book talks a lot, gives you a lot of situations.
You've done any why the reason why?
Well, the main reason why this happens is simply ignorance and hatred, right? A lot of people just simply don't understand Islam and Muslims and react out of fear, and then they say and do things that unfortunately, you know, are discriminatory. And that's what we see a lot of.
And post 9/11, it became more...
Oh, yeah, much more even, yeah. And in fact, so there is actually the... The Southern Poverty Law Center, they actually did a study right after the election, and they found that the number of incidents like skyrocketed by over 200%.
Which election, 2016?
Yeah, the 2016. Yeah. Yeah. And there were many, many, many more discrimination claims and, you know, hate crimes that happened. And sadly, the two places that had the highest rates were K-12 and university levels. That these incidents were happening. Yeah. So the book talks about you know, incidents and you know, times of discrimination that happened. I don't know if you remember the three Chapel Hill students that were actually killed execution style by their neighbor, which the media decided to call it a parking dispute. But he had actually been threatening these kids for like 6 months since they moved into that housing complex. And then he knocked on their door and shot the first two and then walked into the house and shot the third one. And their anniversary is actually coming up this week. Yeah. So, you know, that moment, that dark moment in history. Here in New York, if you remember the two imams in Queens 3 years ago, they were gunned down by a gentleman, execution style, 1 o'clock in the afternoon. They went to pray, they're dressed in their religious garb, and they went to pray at the mosque, and they were leaving the mosque, going back to their homes, and they were shot from the back by a gentleman who just decided to come out of his car and shoot them. Yeah. So, yep. So there's a lot of education that needs to get done. And, you know, my book, you know, when putting it together, I wanted to put something together that could actually bring people of all walks of life, not just educators, but people who care about people, right? So, you know, the fact that there's the Jewish and Catholic experience in the book shows us that, you know, sadly, historically, our nation, you know, has a problem with race and bigotry, and what do we need to do? How do we deal with that, right? How do we not keep repeating the same cycles? And so, you know, it just gives a lot of pathways for people to talk about this topic of bigotry and racism and discrimination through the stories of these people. Yeah. Yes?
Just a question about the publication process. Mm-hmm.
Oh my God, how long did it take to get published? So my dissertation was actually, it was over 300 pages long. And it was a labor of love. It was an absolute labor of love. So I put together a book proposal and I actually shopped it around. And the first two publishers were like, it's a dissertation? No, we're not interested. So then the third publisher, which is this publisher, I then, you know, actually rewrote the proposal, and I didn't make it seem like it was a dissertation, but I told him it was a study. So he was like, okay, well, you know, give us the first two chapters and we'll read it and give you feedback. And so what I literally had to do, I mean, how many of you here are academics or have read academic stuff? I literally had to break down sentences and make them simple and shorter and the paragraph shorter. Like, it was a totally brand new set of revisions. And so, like, when you take what's in the book and you take what's in the dissertation, they're not similar in terms of the length of sentences. But of course, the meanings and what was being put across. So that was the most grueling part. I actually went through three revisions until I got it right. And I was like, oh my God, I can't take this anymore. I kept saying every time chapters would get kicked back to me. So I got the book deal in 2017. In the fall of 2017, and I finally submitted everything by 2018, in the fall. And you have no idea how I was praying that they don't contact me with any more revisions. And what was interesting, this publisher, what they did was they also had it peer reviewed, which I didn't know. Like, I teach now at the College of Staten Island, and everybody's been asking me, has your book been peer reviewed? And so my publisher just told me, yeah, your book was peer reviewed, because so they review it and they give you their edits, but they also have other people, academics, who actually read it and peer review it and then give you feedback. So I had the publisher's feedback to you know, incorporate, and then I had four other people's feedback to incorporate. And it wasn't as intense as I thought, because I was like, oh my God, five people are giving me feedback. How am I going to handle this? But it was really fine. Thank you for asking that question, because people don't realize sometimes how grueling it is to put a book together. And I don't know if anybody in the audience has written a book to you know, relate to this. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you all so much for coming.